The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
If you're familiar with cloud computing, you probably know that Amazon Web Services offers a complete set of secure compute, storage, application, and deployment services that help companies launch and scale their IT infrastructures while lowering costs. But did you know that you're still responsible for protecting your own AWS-based assets, meaning your applications and data, from advanced cyber threats? Protect your AWS with Barracuda Networks Advanced Firewall Solutions. Visit AWS Marketplace or barracuda.com/AWS to learn more.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Who would be a better leader for the United States on the world stage? That was a major focus for the presidential candidates this past week. We'll have full coverage. Later, North Korea's nuclear test. Is there any effective reaction to take? And in Chicago, 13 murders last weekend. More than 500 so far this year. You'll hear CBS's Dean Reynolds.
The 65 people shot in Chicago over the Labor Day holiday weekend included a woman 9 months pregnant, shot in the abdomen, a pastor shot in the face, an 80-year-old man shot in the head, as well as several teenagers.
Also, this weekend marks 15 years since the attacks of 9/11 that changed us forever. Members of Congress sang together to show America's resolve. We'll report on issues very much unresolved 15 years after that awful September 11th. I'm Dan Revive at CBS News in Washington. Let's begin this weekend roundup with the race for the White House. Election Day is 8 weeks from this coming Tuesday. And the first debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump is just 2 weeks from Monday. We had a kind of warm-up when NBC News hosted the Commander-in-Chief Forum on the aircraft carrier Intrepid, now a docked museum in New York City. Clinton answered questions, some from military veterans who were very skeptical of her. Then the same audience questioned Trump. Each got half an hour. CBS's Nancy Cordes reported the next day, Thursday, on the post-forum spin.
It's a game to him. Everything is a game.
Clinton argued that's the only explanation for some of Trump's claims.
The generals have been reduced to rubble.
He called military leaders embarrassing and claimed the U.S. should have seized Iraq's oil reserves when it had the chance.
How are we going to do that?
Just you would leave a certain group behind and you would take various sections where they have the oil.
The United States of America does not invade other countries to plunder and pillage. We don't send our brave men and women around the world to steal oil.
President Obama, traveling in Laos, said it shows Trump is unqualified.
Every time he speaks, that opinion is confirmed.
Clinton also spoke.
We are not putting ground troops into Iraq ever again.
She was criticized by GOP chair Reince Priebus for not smiling enough while discussing national security. She was asked if she found the comment sexist.
And I don't take anything seriously that comes from the RNC. We were talking about serious issues.
Clinton did acknowledge in an interview posted on Facebook that, quote, I know I can be perceived as aloof or cold or unemotional, but I had to learn as a young woman to control my emotions. She said it came from being a female law student at a time when that was rare. That's a hard path to walk, she said. You need to protect yourself. But at the same time, you don't want to seem walled off. And sometimes I think I come across more in the walled off arena.
That's what Hillary Clinton said for the blog called Humans of New York. A controversy after that Commander-in-Chief forum centered on why Trump keeps saying positive things about Russia's tough guy president, Vladimir Putin. CBS's Major Garrett reported.
If he says great things about me, I'm going to say great things about him. I've already said he is really very much of a leader. And the man has very strong control over a country. Now, it's a very different system, and I don't happen to like the system. But certainly in that system, he's been a leader far more than our president has been a leader.
Hillary Clinton defended President Obama and called Trump's comments alarming.
That is not just unpatriotic and insulting to the people of our country as well as to our commander-in-chief. It is scary because it suggests he will let Putin do whatever Putin wants to do. And then make excuses for him.
I have no faith in Hillary Clinton or the leadership. I think under the leadership of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, the generals have been reduced to rubble.
Clinton then asked how the Republican Party's toughest cold warrior would react.
What would Ronald Reagan say about a Republican nominee who attacks America's generals and heaps praise on Russia's president? I think we know the answer.
Trump again seemed pro-Putin and said he did not think that Russia hacked America's Democratic Party when he spoke on Larry King's talk show, which these days is on RT, the channel owned by Russia's government.
I don't know who hacked. I'm not sure who. I mean, you tell me who hacked, who did the hacking, but I have absolutely no opinion on that. I don't know.
The Trump campaign says the candidate didn't realize he was on Russian TV. Let's go back to Tuesday. Just after the Labor Day holiday weekend, Major Garrett reported.
For the first time since the Democratic National Convention, a national poll gives Donald Trump a narrow 2-point lead over Hillary Clinton, something the poll-conscious nominee noticed during a stop in Virginia Beach.
People that didn't call me yesterday, they're calling me today. But I think we're doing very well.
While Trump has momentum, another poll shows him down 6. And Clinton retains important polling and organizational advantages in battleground states. Trump's campaign unveiled a list of nearly 90 generals and admirals endorsing his candidacy and the promise of more military spending.
And these are our fighters. These are our fighting generals and... there are actually a lot more to come.
CBS's Major Garrett reporting this past Tuesday. Here's John Dickerson, host of Face the Nation, which is on CBS every Sunday. He notes that Hillary Clinton has experience and command of foreign policy facts, but even when Trump says something that draws controversy, his fans don't mind.
No, Hillary Clinton's supporters love her command of information, but beyond her core supporters, there are voters for whom that specificity isn't enough. Those voters have one of two emotional reactions to the race. Either they don't trust Hillary Clinton, or they have some kind of a gut-level connection to Donald Trump. And Hillary Clinton isn't going to break through that emotional connection simply by mastering the material. The only way she can, say pollsters and strategists I talked to today, is by making Trump seem unfit for the job, essentially replacing one emotional reaction with another one, fear. But for those who don't already see Donald Trump as unfit, making him seem unfit isn't just about the facts. It's about the voters who like him are willing to think he can grow on the job. They think he can surround himself with advisors. They think he was in business and was a success in the primaries, so he must know something. And there's another thing. They think judgment can replace smarts and experience.
Judgment over experience. Let's hear from Anthony Salvanto, CBS News Director of Elections, presenting our poll of battleground states. Looking good for the Democrat this year.
We have watched Hillary Clinton build polling leads in battleground state after battleground state. Some of them slight, but some of them sizable, double-digit leads. But a lead is a lead. And all of that adds up to, if the election were held today, a sizable electoral vote advantage for Hillary Clinton, far more than the 270 that she would need. In fact, it's so large that if she were to, say, drop a state like Ohio or Florida and still win the other states in which she has a lead, she would still get elected.
Trump supporters say that will change. They like the Quinnipiac poll results that indicate pretty much a tie in Ohio and Florida. Trump aims to catch up in North Carolina and Pennsylvania and tighten a Republican grip on Georgia. Stay with us. We'll discuss North Korea's nuclear bomb test and the upsetting number of murders in Chicago. Those stories and more on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Dan Revive. North Korea wants attention, and it's getting it. The reclusive communist dictatorship announced its fifth test explosion of an atom bomb, weaker than the two bombs the U.S. dropped on Japan to end World War II in 1945. But the North Koreans claim they've designed a small nuclear warhead that could reach America's west coast. CBS News Asia correspondent Adriana Diaz.
They say they have the capacity to put a nuclear warhead on a missile and launch it. Analysts really aren't sure. We spoke to one today who said it's hard to say. But in terms of the technology of their missiles without a nuclear warhead on it, those can certainly reach countries that are neighbors to North Korea, but doesn't have the capacity to reach the lower 48 in the U.S.
We had more on Friday from reporter Jason Struther in Seoul, South Korea.
North Korea's fifth nuclear test appears to be its strongest. The Pyongyang regime says it will continue to strengthen its nuclear capabilities. South Korean President Park Geun-hye condemned the test. She's cut her trip to Southeast Asia short and is returning home.
Also, Japan and even China condemned the nuclear explosion. Experts said North Korea was probably reacting to military maneuvers in the Pacific by the U.S. and its allies, also reacting to the G20 summit that President Obama attended last weekend in China. His defense secretary spoke about North Korea Friday, as CBS's Cammie McCormick reports.
This nuclear test constitutes a direct challenge to the entire international community.
On a visit to Norway, Defense Secretary Ash Carter said the U.S. remains committed to the security of its allies in the region. He spoke to his South Korean counterpart after the test.
I will continue to remain in close contact with Minister Han and our other allies and partners in the region and with our commanders as we monitor the situation and assess our next steps.
Carter also called on China to pressure North Korea into stopping its nuclear tests. Cammie McCormick, CBS News, Washington.
Let's turn to former U.S. diplomat Aaron David Miller, now at the Wilson Center here in D.C., author of a book called The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. Aaron, what are President Obama's options to respond to North Korea's nuclear test?
I mean, if you look at history as any guide, the options for stopping powers who are determined to acquire nuclear weapons, and North Korea, I think, is one of them, are slim to none. You've got four powers outside the five permanent members of the Security Council: Israel, India, Pakistan, and North Korea. All have nuclear weapons and delivery mechanisms, and we have been unable to prevent any of them from acquiring these weapons. If Kim Jong-un wants this weapon, and it seems to me he may, what he wants to do with it is another matter. It seems to me it's very unlikely that we're going to be able to stop him. In fact, the horse is already out of the barn.
The nuclear horse is out of the barn. The front page of the Washington Post on Friday, Aaron, said that just in recent weeks, the U.S. has used military force bombing Muslim extremists in six countries, not just Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria, also Libya, Somalia, and Yemen. Do you think President Obama is trying to take care of business, accomplish some big things, perhaps using the military before he leaves office this coming January?
No. What you're describing is an asymmetrical war against a variety of jihadi groups with which we will continue to be at odds and, frankly, at war for years to come. 15th anniversary of 9/11, and al-Qaeda is thriving. Its ISIS derivative in different forms is thriving. You've got the Taliban in Afghanistan. And as Arab states melt down, the idea of empty spaces, sanctuaries, and transnational terror groups become a reality. So no, there's no end to this business, no comprehensive solution. The next president that is lucky enough to sit and grapple with a world of migraine headaches and root canals are going to have to deal with the problem of jihadi terror.
The world that Trump or Clinton will inherit is like a migraine headache or a root canal. That's Aaron David Miller at the Wilson Center. Thank you.
You're welcome.
In the race for the White House, the presidential candidate of the Libertarian Party, Gary Johnson, a former Republican governor of New Mexico, admits to being embarrassed for not recognizing the name of a city in Syria where civil war victims are suffering. That was on MSNBC's Morning Joe.
What would you do if you were elected about Aleppo?
About?
Aleppo.
And what is Aleppo?
You're kidding.
No.
Aleppo is in Syria. It's the epicenter of the refugee crisis.
Okay, got it. Got it.
We have more from CBS News correspondent Juliana Goldman.
In a statement to CBS News, Johnson said he's human and he blanked. Should I have identified Aleppo? Yes. Do I understand its significance? Yes.
Is this the craziest election ever?
Johnson's foreign policy flap couldn't have come at a worse time for the former New Mexico governor. He's been trying to raise his profile and his poll numbers to secure a spot on the debate stage with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. To get there, he needs 15% support in five national polls, and Johnson is currently averaging under 9%.
It might be worth considering that he never claimed to focus on foreign affairs. Hardly anybody thinks he could be elected president and have those headaches. The point is to propagate some libertarian views, a smaller role for government. And this year, with polls indicating the two big party candidates are unpopular, Gary Johnson and his running mate, also a former governor, William Weld, hope to make an impression. The company that owns Fox News has reached a financial settlement with several women who claimed sexual harassment by longtime boss Roger Ailes. He was forced to quit 2 months ago, pocketing a reported $40 million. Now the company, to settle Gretchen Carlson's lawsuit against Ailes, is paying her a reported $20 million. Now the epidemic of fatal shootings in Chicago continues. Last weekend, 65 people were shot, 13 of them died. That included the 500th murder in the Windy City this year, the worst year in two decades. On Tuesday, CBS News national correspondent Dean Reynolds reported.
The 65 people shot in Chicago over the Labor Day holiday weekend included a woman 9 months pregnant shot in the abdomen, a pastor shot in the face, an 80-year-old man shot in the head, as well as several teenagers. A weekend so bloody it surpassed earlier holiday carnage on Memorial Day and the 4th of July. The victims were found on sidewalks, in driveways, on street corners, and in city parks. Pat, she didn't want to give her last name, was an eyewitness.
I just basically saw a guy drive up in a nice car and jumped out, started shooting towards the park, and once he finished, he took off.
In other parts of town, a victim was murdered as he was driving, another as he walked his dog.
I'm frustrated. The city should be frustrated. And frustrated that the people who commit these crimes just don't care who their actions affect.
Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson said there was a surge in violence because of youthful gang reprisals for petty insults or juvenile arguments. Most offenders this year have been between 15 and 24 years old. Johnson said his officers need help.
We need the people in the community to do the right thing, because as long as they stay silent, then the people committing these acts feel empowered to continue doing it.
That from CBS's Dean Reynolds in Chicago. Up next, awful health problems linked with 9/11. We are at the 15th anniversary of the attacks. And more on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Posting your job in just one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites. And now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 100 plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with one single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No more juggling emails or calls to your office. You can quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 800,000 businesses. And right now, listeners of the show can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. That's ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. One more time so you can try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Dan Revive. You're hearing members of the House of Representatives look like most of them just below the gorgeously renovated dome of the Capitol at a bipartisan gathering in memory of 9/11, 15 years ago, the attack on the U.S. CBS News national correspondent Jim Axelrod reports there have been more than 5,000 cancer cases, which many experts link with toxic dust in the debris of the Twin Towers in New York.
As an EMT with the New York Fire Department, Sal Tortorici spent months after the attacks working at Ground Zero during the recovery effort. Every September 11th since, he's paused to remember others, keeping them in his prayers. Now, in a cruel twist, Sal is no longer the one providing the prayers. He's the one who needs them.
This is what really changed your life.
Yes.
This is it.
The diagnosis came last October. The sudden pain in Sal Tortorici's stomach? Cancer, the doctor said, attacking several organs at once.
They said that the cancer was in here for approximately 7 years. And I can't believe it.
7 years?
7 years it's been in him. Not a pain.
Yeah, I didn't have any kind
blood
of
nothing.
Any kind of sign or symptom. I didn't have
nothing.
Anything.
After multiple surgeries, doctors are now telling this father of three there is little they can do.
I want to be there for them. I want to walk my daughter down the aisle. I want to see my boys graduate college. I want to see this all happen, and I'm not sure I'm going to get there.
The federal government's World Trade Center health program has linked Tortorici's condition to the toxins he faced at Ground Zero. he joins a growing list of responders who've fallen ill long after the attacks.
As you began to see people get sick, were you worried about yourself?
No.
Why not?
I just didn't have any idea I would think it. I didn't even think about it.
Thank you.
Dr. Michael Crane has given it plenty of thought. He runs the 9/11 Health Program Clinic at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York.
Sal's story, you anticipate being told more and more and more in the upcoming years.
I want to say no, but the answer is yes.
Among the nearly 75,000 responders and survivors health officials are monitoring, they've certified more than 5,400 patients with 9/11-related cancers. And Dr. Crane says the numbers continue to rise.
Here at Sinai, we see 10 to 15 new cancer patients in our population every week.
10 to 15 cases of first responders?
Per week.
Each week.
I've been in medicine for 40-odd years. It's remarkable.
Mirna A. Duarte.
Responders who died from illnesses after the attacks are not among those listed at the National September 11th Memorial. But a former Ground Zero construction worker is keeping track at his own memorial, 45 miles away.
We're 15 years removed from 9/11. We are out of sight, out of mind.
John Feel adds new names every year to this wall on Long Island.
Sal, like the others, was a warrior and still is. And he's fighting the good fight. And listen, we're hoping for a miracle, but reality dictates that Sal Tucci goes on this wall.
Come do your tomatoes with Dad.
Reality is sinking in here on Staten Island, where these parents say they're doing what they can while they can to make memories for their children.
Don't forget about us. Don't forget about the families.
You got to remember.
Remember what, Sal?
Remember that this is what happened. This is the history. This is our legacy. They died, and we're dying. And hopefully that you think about us and remember us and keep us in your prayers.
That from CBS's Jim Axelrod in New York. Let's take a look at Congress. Back at work since this past Tuesday, CBS News correspondent Stephen Portnoy at the Capitol. Let's begin with the House passage of a bill called JASTA. It's related to 9/11.
The Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act. It sailed through the House on a voice vote on Friday. Following on similar approval in the Senate in May, it removes sovereign immunity protections from governments allegedly tied to terror and would, in this specific case, allow 9/11 families to sue Saudi Arabia. Now, the Saudis have steadfastly denied any involvement with 9/11, despite what was reported in the so-called 28 pages released a few months ago. The Saudis lobbied hard against this bill, but it still passed with strong bipartisan support. The White House has warned that other countries could retaliate and take away sovereign immunity for the U.S. in foreign courts, and a veto threat the president issued months ago still stands. The question then would be, would Congress override this presidential veto? The point I'd make is that hasn't happened yet. In the 8 years of the Obama presidency, Congress has not successfully overridden one of his vetoes.
But that bill had the kind of support it could happen. Stephen, what else is on the work agenda? And how many weeks will legislators be in session now?
Congress has until the end of this month just 13 more scheduled days until the House goes back out on recess for the entire month of October through the election. And the main issue here now is government funding. The major imperative on the part of GOP leaders is to avoid a government shutdown just a month before the election. And talks began this past week on the Senate side of the Capitol on a short-term stopgap measure that would keep agencies funded through December 9th. Key questions. Will this continuing resolution include any money to fight Zika? And will this package be acceptable to Republicans in the House? Some of them are saying that they want to tie a ban on Syrian refugees to any government funding package. Of course, Democrats would find that unacceptable.
And among Republicans, there's talk of an impeachment, which could lead to a trial in the Senate. But, Stephen, that's not about President Obama.
No, it's not, even if some Republicans might like it to be. This is about the IRS commissioner, a man named John Koskinen. He was not in charge of the IRS when the agency scrutinized Tea Party groups a few years ago. But Republicans say that he has been evasive, unresponsive to their demands for Lois Lerner's emails and the details for how they were erased. This issue is a headache for Speaker Ryan because it's being pushed by the House Freedom Caucus, the members who caused such trouble for John Boehner about a year ago, leading to his ouster. It could be a headache for Senate Republicans, too, because a successful vote to impeach Koskinen in the House would trigger a trial in the Senate. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell could dispense with it, not even bother to convene a trial, but then he'd be angering those House conservatives.
Stephen, a big picture question. How does the presidential election affect what Congress will or won't do between now and Election Day in November?
There's not much hope that anything major is going to get done here in Congress between now and the election. The main push here in Congress is to fund the government and come up with some money to fight Zika. After that, members of Congress hope to get themselves reelected. And there are some key races that we're watching. Democrats are hoping they might be able to take control of the Senate back from Republicans, and they even hope to narrow the Republican margin in the House.
CBS News congressional correspondent Stephen Portnoy. Thank you.
You bet.
Please follow us on Twitter for the latest headlines at CBS Radio News. And I'm at Dan Revive on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Dan Revive. Many Republicans and critics of the nuclear deal with Iran last year are outraged now that it's been made public that the United States government delivered $1.7 billion to the Islamic Republic of Iran this year, starting with a plane load of cash, $400 million worth of euros and other foreign currency, obviously timed to coincide with the release by Iran of four U.S. citizens. CBS News correspondent Margaret Brennan, who was traveling with President Obama on his trip to China and Laos, reported.
The Treasury Department says that an international court would have forced the U.S. to pay Iran close to $10 billion in interest over a failed arms deal dispute that dates back more than three decades. Instead, the U.S. decided to make a payment in multiple cash installments totaling $1.3 billion. The White House says this was not a ransom payment. It had acknowledged the deal at the time, and in fact, they believe they saved American taxpayers' money.
Details of the cash transfers were revealed by the Wall Street Journal. Jay Solomon, you're one of the lead reporters on this, and author of a new book called The Iran Wars. Jay, in your book, you bring us back to the 2008 presidential campaign, and you say that relations with Iran came up, but mainly because Senator Barack Obama said he would reach out to the Iranians. And during the primary campaign, Hillary Clinton said that's naive. So you say that Clinton is relatively a hardliner. That's important for us to know now. So do you expect if Clinton wins, she'll be tougher on Iran than Obama has been?
I mean, certainly the history would suggest that. On the campaign trail, and her advisors say that they will be much tougher. They'll support the nuclear agreement, but they'll be much more willing to try to constrain Iran, whether it's their activities in Syria, Yemen, in Iraq. They'd be more willing to start using sanctions again. But that will raise a question, because Iranians have said any new sanctions on their regime by a new administration will be seen as a violation of the nuclear agreement. So will Clinton really go ahead with kind of turning the financial screws again if Iran keeps shooting off missiles? It remains to be seen. But she has vowed to take a tougher line than what the Obama administration have done over the past couple of years.
Jay, what's your view of the nuclear deal with Iran? Will it delay that country from pursuing nuclear weapons?
I mean, I think it will definitely delay them. The real problem, though, is in 10 years, basically, they're given the green light by the international community to develop an industrial-scale civilian nuclear program, and the ghosts of what they've done over the past 15 years weren't really resolved. The fear is that in 10 years, these guys will be unleashed to develop as much fissile material as they want. And whatever knowledge they had of making a bomb, I think, will still be there. And the U.S.'s ability at that point to ratchet up sanctions if they cheat or look like they're going towards weaponization will be very difficult to reconstitute what they did over the past decade.
Before I let you go, recently in the Wall Street Journal, you're one of the reporters who revealed how foreign cash was delivered to Iran, and just about the same time that U.S. citizens were being released. Quid pro quo, was it ransom? Lots of controversy. But what were you trying to say? Just a sexy detail of how cash is delivered in such odd circumstances?
I mean, when the U.S. announced this settlement the day of the release of the prisoners in January, it was immediately kind of strange. Like, okay, they're announcing these release at the same time that this $1.7 billion transaction is going to be made. And we couldn't figure out, and the administration would not say how it was made. It was definitely sequenced. And in that sense, it feels like it's a quid pro quo. The administration will deny it. But, you know, they admit that it was sequenced, that it was timed. And I think there's still real questions out there. I know one we're still trying to figure out is who exactly from the Iranian side picked up this $400 million. Was it the Revolutionary Guard, the militant wing, which is accused of being involved in terrorist operations? That issue is going to continue to be part of the presidential campaign. If the administration keeps obfuscating, I don't think this issue is just going to die down.
Now I see why you're pursuing it for the Wall Street Journal. That's Jay Solomon, foreign affairs correspondent for that newspaper, and as you heard, author of a new book called The Iran Wars. Jay Solomon, thank you very much.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
There are two new movies based on events we've covered here at CBS News. One is called Snowden by filmmaker Oliver Stone. It portrays the decision by NSA employee Edward Snowden to take a huge number of secrets about surveillance programs and leak them to the world. Now he lives in Russia. Reviewers say the movie makes Snowden look like a hero. And his lawyer says it may lead to one day Snowden returning to the U.S., perhaps to face trial if and when the public supports him. Then there's the hero Sully Sullivan, the pilot of the U.S. Airways plane that made an emergency landing on the Hudson River between New York City and New Jersey in 2009. In the new movie, Sully, Tom Hanks plays the pilot, but the real Sullivan is a CBS News consultant who went back to the scene on the Hudson with Charlie Rose of CBS This Morning.
It's been more than 7 years since that miracle on the Hudson. Returning to the river with Sully, it is evident the moment remains fresh on his mind.
What could have gone wrong on the Hudson?
If we had touched with one wing too low, if we hadn't had the wings exactly level, it would have spun us around. The aircraft might have broken apart. If we had landed with too great a rate of descent, the airplane might have broken apart and wouldn't have floated long enough for the rescue to take place. If we had misjudged the height at which to begin the landing, even by a fraction of a second.
We're going to end up in the Hudson.
I'm sorry, say again, Cactus?
So there's this movie out there, and you're played by Tom Hanks.
Tom came to our home and spent almost half a day there, and one of the first things we talked about was the responsibility he felt about playing a real person still living. But that after the film has run its course, I'll have to go back to living my life, and he wanted to be sure he didn't screw it up for me.
As far as you see, the moment and the personality, they captured it.
And the emotion. And what I really wanted this film to have was a real undercurrent of the importance of our common humanity. And I think it's there.
How so?
This is about a group of people at a time in the world's history when it seemed as if everything was going wrong during the 08-09 financial meltdown. It seemed like no one could do anything right. And this group of people who didn't know each other came together in this place, in this time, and made it their mission in life to see that every life was saved.
I've delivered a million passengers over 40 years in the air, but in the end, I'm going to be judged on 208 seconds.
Did you make any mistakes?
Of course. It wasn't perfect, but it worked. And I was confident I could find something that would work.
And it changed your life forever?
Instantly, completely, forever.
Sully Sullivan, former airline pilot, hero for landing a plane on the Hudson in 2009. The new movie about his feat and the questions and pressures he then faced is called Sully. Up next, a missing flag from the 9/11 disaster site in New York has been found. That and more on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
America was built by people with a few dollars and a dream. And while many don't know it, there's one path to success that still only requires a dream and about $10. That's right. If your dream is to start or grow your business, something as simple as the right business card could make all the difference. And today, at Vistaprint.com, you can get 500 full-color business cards for only $9.99. That's right, only $9.99. Just go to Vistaprint.com and enter promo code 1919 at checkout. That's Vistaprint.com, promo code 1919.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Dan Revive. Thinking back to 15 years ago, the attacks of 9/11, the anniversary this weekend on Sunday, there's the intriguing tale of the American flag that was raised over the rubble of the World Trade Center on that September 11th evening by New York firefighters. The famous photo was reminiscent of Iwo Jima during World War II. Defiance, heroism, and sacrifice. The flag came down, then was missing for almost 15 years. Brad Meltzer, you were involved in finding it on an episode of your History Channel TV series. You showed the flag. You asked the public to help locate it. Wednesday, you took part in a ceremony at Ground Zero when the National September 11th Memorial Museum put the flag on display. Brad, where was the flag all these years?
Somewhere in Washington State, because that was where it was turned in. A man who identified himself as a former Marine saw our show Lost History, walked into a firehouse. As far as we know, he says he got it from someone who got it from a widow, but no one can verify that story. And to this day, no one knows who the missing Marine is.
And a forensic laboratory has confirmed it's the flag?
The dust from 9/11 is like a fingerprint. It's made up of not just buildings, but of jet fuel and of human remains. And as our forensic expert said to me, this is a fingerprint. He said, I'd stake my house on this one. So now we know it's a flag that was at 9/11. The question is it the 9/11 flag? And that came from an eyewitness who used to work on the boat where the flag was taken from. And more importantly, when you look at the actual photographic evidence of the flag itself, the key thing are the halyards. And that halyard on the flag is very particular. Usually you'll see a halyard that'll have that little round circle and that little clip you put in it, and it'll usually be, you know, be silver or it'll be copper. This one is actually one of each. It was a homemade one, and that's where we got lucky. And what you can't see in a close-up of the photo, when you look at the photo in high definition, is you can see that that halyard is very particular, along with the tape that goes around it. And that's where we had a perfect match.
Yeah, one of each. Boy, that is certainly distinctive. Now, what will happen to the flag? It's being unveiled to the world, you might say, at this now famous museum, the 9/11 Memorial and Museum at Ground Zero. Do they want to keep it there? What's your understanding?
Our real goal was we always wanted to donate it to its really true final resting place and the place it should be, the 9/11 Memorial and Museum. It will be there permanently. It will be on display. And it is proof that heroes exist in this world. And that's what we want, is we want kids to be able to go see it.
And as you get tips on other missing historical relics?
When you call for help, people answer. That's what the American people did. We asked for help and they answered.
Brad Meltzer, a best-selling author on the History Channel this Sunday evening on 9/11, he's telling the story of that flag. Also from the pages of history, 1971, a prison uprising in New York State. Steve Kathan, who anchors the CBS World News Roundup every weekday morning, reports.
45 years ago this weekend, chaos, confusion, and bloodshed as 1,000 inmates rioted over poor conditions and took control at New York's Attica prison. 42 guards held hostage. It goes on for 4 days. There are negotiations, but eventually state police retake the prison by force. 29 inmates and 10 guards are killed. Historian Heather Ann Thompson has written a new book, Blood in the Water. It uncovers new details from behind the walls at Attica, and she joins me now. In fact, you write that during the crisis, there were two camps of people, one that thought negotiations would work through a group of observers.
Yes, and what is really significant about that is that the negotiations between the prisoners and the state of New York were really endorsed by lots and lots of folks on the scene. There was a group of observers that were from many different political walks of life who universally agreed that negotiations should continue and told the state of New York, specifically then Governor Nelson Rockefeller, that if there would be a forcible retaking, it would be, to use their words, a massacre. Even the hostages whom the prisoners had taken to ensure negotiations were telling the governor, don't come in with force. Folks, have some legitimate grievances, hear them out, negotiate.
So Governor Rockefeller is in the other camp, and the Nixon White House is too. They wanted action.
Rockefeller and indeed the New York State Police had been itching to get in for days. And ultimately, it was a political decision, I believe. Rockefeller needed to draw the line in the sand that he was tough on crime and felt that he needed a show of force so that everyone would know that he was not going to coddle criminals, to use his term. The problem was that he sent in nearly 600 state troopers armed to the teeth who had deliberately not recorded their weapons, their serial numbers, had taken off their identifying badges. And within 15 minutes, it was an absolute shooting spree. 39 men shot to death, both prisoners and hostages, and 128 so severely wounded, you know, permanently maimed. Some had 6-7 bullet wounds. And then began that effort on the part of the state, from the governor's office to the head of state police, to make sure that this did not end up in criminal indictments against police officers.
In fact, it was first claimed that prisoners did most of the killing, but as you detail, police shot at random as they entered the prison, killing most of those who died. And what came next after New York State retook control of Attica was torture.
The prisoners had been saying from the beginning that the ordeal of the post-retaking was really the story. They were tortured for days and weeks, and no one believed them. And indeed, the state denied it all the way to this day. The state has not taken responsibility, even though prisoners ultimately were able to tell their stories and receive a settlement from the state for the abuse and torture they received. Part of this research, though, was clear that, yes, they knew that there was torture going on, but at every level, no one stepped in, no one stopped it, and no one held the state accountable for it.
Attica! 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 Attica!
Now, the word Attica has since become a catch-all rallying cry, from the movies, as we hear there, to all kinds of protests. And the anniversary comes as there is a new look at who is serving time in our prisons, and conflict between police and people in some of the communities they serve.
We do have great tensions again. Police officers who have ended up killing unarmed black citizens, and the black communities feeling that there is not equal justice under the law, that they are not indicted. And when they are, the rare times they are, they're never convicted. Attica has a lot to say to that. I mean, it really shows us that just because people aren't indicted or just because they are not convicted does not mean there was insufficient evidence, and it does not mean that crimes weren't committed.
Heather Ann Thompson, thanks very much. The book is Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. For the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Kathan.
Our thanks to Steve and to you for listening. Anytime you want to hear us, including previous episodes, please do a web search for CBS Weekend Roundup. And remember our app for your smartphone. The free app is CBS Radio News. The Weekend Roundup is produced in Washington by Howard Arenstein. Have a great week. I'm Dan Raviv, CBS News.